Hello, everyone. Welcome to Laser Focus. This is the deep dive pop culture podcast from Nerdist. My name is Kyle Anderson. Thank you so much for listening. This week, we're going to be talking about the Fallout TV series, which by now, hopefully, you have gotten a chance to watch all of, for we will spoil the whole thing. This is one of our roundtable episodes, which we've had a few times in the recent past. And joining me are two of my colleagues, two of my very smart and thoughtful, two different things, apparently, Nerdist writers and editors. So first of all, welcome, Ro Rusek. Hello, Ro.
Hi. So good to be here.
And also welcome, Michael Walsh. Hey, Mikey.
Yes, and me too, also.
As well, Tom Bien. So, yeah, we have sort of, as a society, no, as a bullpen, have been kind of obsessed with Fallout for the last little bit. And, I mean, we can get right into why it's annoying that that everything dropped all at once. I think most people are wishing it was a weekly show, or at least, like, you know, doing the normal Prime Video thing of dropping a few at the beginning and then doing the rest, because that would have meant more and more time for us to kind of think about stuff and speculate. But as a function of our jobs, we got the episodes a bit early. So we had a little more time to be excited about these things. But Ro interviewed the cast and the writers and director Jonathan Nolan, which you can find on Nerdist's YouTube. And it was, those interviews turned out great. But did you get any insights from them that you were kind of surprised about?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I was so surprised, but I think it was, like, really nice to hear how thoughtful they were and how they were really at their heart trying to, like, do justice to the Fallout universe by adding something that was essentially comparable to, like, a new Fallout game. And I think that it was really nice that when they did that, there was this honoring, but also this, like, evolving that took place that everybody seemed keen on. So it wasn't just, like, an inert piece of canon, just sort of set dressing for us to revisit the world, but it actually moved the world forward, which I think was, you know, important to the creators, and I think is important to why it's actually successful, because it's really taking swings and being like, okay, we are in the Fallout canon. Given that we are in the Fallout canon, we may as well do something, you know. So I thought that was really an interesting part. And then everybody just, you know, seemed to really love the world and really like each other, and that always makes for a good series.
I think it's what you're saying about having it be part of the canon and not just, because, like, as good as The Last of Us is, it is just an adaptation of the game story. Like, it's, you know, not quite exactly a one-to-one, but it's very close. It's following the same line of story. Whereas Fallout is, it's got all the pieces, you know, the different factions or, and kind of the general vibe of the world, but because of the function of the games being I think in all of them, or most of them, you're a vault dweller who doesn't know much about the world outside. And so you make your own character, you can take your own paths and stuff like that, and kind of make your own alliances. There is no one story for Fallout. So I think doing it like that, and that's always been something, you know, they tried it, I guess, with the Warcraft movie several years ago, and I think some other games. But if the game, or movie adaptations, but if a game is too open-ended or too kind of dependent on the player to kind of create, you know, stories and stuff like that, I think you run the risk of kind of alienating people who don't play like that. And I think just kind of the way that they did it, by kind of focusing on the different people from different, you know, parts of it, and just kind of showing the backstory also of the bomb dropping, that was kind of the most interesting part, because that's, you know, you get little bits of it and little hints here and there in the games, but you don't necessarily get the full, you know, this is what happens when the bomb drops and who did it and all that stuff. I think it's been kind of implied that that's what happened, but, you know, I don't think it's ever been fully said. Anyway, Mikey, what was, you come into this not having not played the games. I mean, Ro hasn't either, but Ro has done extensive research, but I think you have too, Mikey, right? Like,
Ro and I have been bouncing ideas back and forth and sharing research, and not just on the clock. There's a lot of Twitter DMs at night being like, hey, I just came across this thing. What do you think about that? Like, just the two giant nerds that I don't even think we've told the rest of the staff just how much we've been messaging about this show for the last few weeks. But
oh, I didn't know that.
We've been all in. Oh yeah, we've been all in.
What was the bit that you were kind of most surprised about while watching, like, or the kind of twist, or maybe not even twist, but just like the wrinkle of the world that you found most compelling?
I really came into this show blind in a way I'm usually not with these things. We just tend to even stuff that we don't necessarily cover or get into, the nature of our job just means we come across a lot of this stuff, right? Like, I don't really know anything about Pokemon, and yet I know a lot about Pokemon just from this job. But Fallout, I was really coming into mostly blind. I didn't even quite understand the setup of the world, or I knew some people were in blue suits and they came out of vaults, and that was about it. And what really pulled me into the show was just how full it felt. It felt like a real place where real people lived, even though some of those people have no noses and raw skin. It just felt full in that, you know, we talk a lot about world building these days, and sometimes we go overboard with it, but I think it was absolutely crucial to making this show succeed. You know, there's a lot of things that went well. I actually think it's pretty flawless. Mm-hmm. I think we got 8 flawless episodes. It might be a little minor quibble here and there, but for the most part, just completely nailed it. But I don't think any of that works if they don't make all of the different aspects, you know, the vault, the surface, the Brotherhood of Steel, all of these feel like real groups, real people, real places. And that is the foundation for the entire show.
Yeah. And I think Mikey and I, we've been talking a lot about how like crazy this lore is. Like, we come across a lot of crazy lore, but like, I feel like Fallout, especially given there are like different endings you could have, like different routes you could take. So there's like so much that like maybe has 3 different ways that the lore could be about it. And like, just like so many details. And it really is like trying to figure out a history of a country, really, when we started reading into it. And I think that's like, that's to me, that is really wild, because most of the time you encounter something and it has a lore and you're like, okay, I could learn the lore pretty quickly. But here it's just like more lore, more lore, more lore. And the show is based at the sort of the farthest point, which is what gives it that freedom to make sort of these swings. But also it's like, okay, well, we have to know everything, kind of. So, but I also think they did a really good job at making it accessible to people who don't know everything.
Yeah, it's funny, like watching the first couple episodes, I watched it with my wife, and I think after the first episode, she was like, I'm confused. And I was like, okay, just, you know, you will be for a little bit, I'm sure. But then I think she really got into it once it kind of, I do think the first episode, it has some like quirk to it, but like once the show finds the balance between like the very strange absurdity of a lot of the stuff, and also like the pretty heavy, you know, drama and, you know, life or death struggle and stuff like that. I think that's where it really shines. Like, you know, it's toward the end when, 2 of our heroes find themselves in a different vault, and it's like, oh, something sinister is going on. And then the punishment at the end is literally just, you are banished. It's like, and we're going to give you some food. And it's just like, it was such a funny,
somebody will carry the food. Don't worry.
It was really funny. And that's the kind of stuff that, like, you know, and then just because that world is weird, like, you know, there's a kind of a aw shucks quality to a lot of the like nastier parts of it. And that's what kind of balances it out. And the fact that like this medical robot that is going to flay her and all this stuff, like, it has the voice of Matt Berry, like, and just sounds so like happy and everything, and it's so, you know, kind of friendly. You know, seeing all of that through Lucy's enormous eyes is really was really helpful to be like, she thinks all the good people are bad, and no, she thinks you know, all the people she thinks are good end up being bad, and vice versa, or, you know, some variation thereof. And that's really one of the hallmarks of the game, is that you don't really know who to trust. And it's not immediately evident that that any one person is trustworthy, and you have to kind of just decide. And that's kind of the complexity of the whole world. One of my favorite things about it is that once you kind of get into it, you realize that there's a good, the bad, and the ugly kind of setup. And that is one of my favorite, it's my favorite movie, but it's also one of my favorite just kind of setups. And so Lucy is obviously the good, and I would say the ghoul or Coop is the bad. And then you have Maximus as the ugly, because he is like more or less a good guy, but also does some really bad stuff and is, you know, and I loved that. I thought that was a really great way to do it. And then, you know, they kind of intersect here and there, but like at no point is there not one of them on the screen for, you know, there's a little, well, I guess you can call like her brother Norm has a different arc. But I think when you have the three out of it, that's where it really worked for me. What do you think, Ro?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was really interesting. That's what they sort of earmarked as like the way they contended with the idea that there isn't choice in the series, but there's choice in the games, is to have these sort of different through lines into the world. And I mean, obviously, I love a morality gradient scale. And then, of course, ultimately, the reveal is that none of them are really the bad. And then somebody else altogether is like the actual sort of villainous figure of everything, which I thought was really clever. And then our heroes are all kind of like, they're all our heroes, even though they have like this intersecting and alternating and sometimes very dark morality to them. And then that's what I like. I like the idea that we're getting to know these three characters. They could have all been at odds and opposed. They probably will sort of have intervals where they're on each other's sides or not. But then ultimately, they probably will all face this other enemy. And that's my favorite thing. When a found family comes together, even though they're still on their way, for sure.
Yeah, that was, I mean, I am all for evil corporatocracies in dystopian fiction. So I was like, hell yeah. Like, of course they're the bad guys. What did you think, Mikey?
I was going to find the excuse to do this anyway. So that's the perfect time. Cause we're going to talk about the three leads. We're going to get into the three leads. I know this is a perfect time. Cause you mentioned him. I think Norm was my favorite character on this show. I absolutely love Norm so much. I want nothing bad to happen to him. I hope when this series ends, he rules the world. He was the best. And, you know, the way they set him up, he's hiding. He's literally hiding in the fight, right? People are fighting for their lives. And he lets his sister put him in a little mini bunker. And then he just spends the rest of the show being like, what's wrong with me? Why am I doing this? What's real? Like, he just knows something's going on a level that nobody else quite understands. And the way they used him, you know, you would think once she left the vault, that was kind of where the interest in the vault ended. And instead, I think it was maybe my favorite part of the show, because it's this like mini mystery that kind of just anchors everything together. I absolutely loved it. I love the interactions. I love the reveal about 31 and, you know, 32 kind of figuring things out. And that's all thanks to my boy Norm, who has never had enthusiasm for anything in his life until it really mattered.
So I have to say that I, you know, sometimes you let your biases cloud you on the old media. And, I feel like I had a moment of that. And I feel like Norm really, like, came through for that kind of character, because I was really like, oh, Norm, he's an incel. He doesn't like anybody. He's mad at everything. I really thought he was going to kill the Raiders. Like, I thought he was going to poison them. You know, somebody poisoned them. I thought it was going to be Norm, because he was like so mad. He didn't want to listen to anybody and like didn't want to do anything. And I was just like, oh, this evil little worm. And then obviously he really evolved. And in the end, you know, did find interest in something and apply himself in some fashion. And I thought his friendship with the other vault man, whose name I don't remember,
Chet, the coward Chet.
Chet was really very dear. So Yeah, I definitely was a norm naysayer and then came around on the norm front by the end.
I loved Norm and Chet walking around looking at stuff because the height discrepancy between those two actors was gargantuan. Like Chet was a huge like wall of a man and Norm is a, you know, Moises Arias is a very short man as well. And so it was just, it was very funny to watch them walk around because it was like, I don't know. That was another thing. Steph kept going, I can't tell if this is a child or a 90-year-old man. And I was like, yeah, it's true. Steph is my wife, by the way. My wife.
Legally, we're legally obligated. Yeah. It's a law.
Yeah. I want to get into, we'll get into all of it, of course, but like, I thought the look of the show was really great. And one of the things that I liked about it is that you could tell they went inside and they built sets. And like, it's so weird how refreshing it is to see like actual sets and actual like locations where they kind of like, because there's nothing that is that nothing looks like the desert except the desert. And that's just the way it is. And you can't get the light anywhere else but the desert. And, you know, it's just, yeah, it is kind of a weird and kind of ethereal place. And so you needed to do that. And I was just really happy to see that, you know, there was obviously tons of CGI in the show because there's things that are, you know, they could not replicate directly. Like the giant mutated axolotl with fingers in his mouth was pretty, what? Yeah, I know, pretty surprising to hear, but wasn't real.
Wasn't real, Kyle? Spoilers.
All I could think, by the way, Kyle, all I could think is, oh yeah, they definitely did not drop real nuclear bombs.
They wanted to.
Those are CGI.
No, they did the same thing they did in Oppenheimer, which was apparently really blow up something. I don't know. No one will tell me what they did, but everyone's like, oh no, it was real. How could it be real? I just watched over the weekend, I watched the movie Them, which is a 1950s sci-fi movie about giant ants that have mutated thanks to the atomic bomb testing, and so they're like 10 feet tall ants, and the whole time I'm like, oh man, that would have just been like the tip of the iceberg in the Fallout universe, because that's so like,
oh, cockroaches, yeah. Were, oh man, I'm not like I don't know, like I'm not one of those people who like loses their mind when there's a giant spider in a movie or something, but for some reason these giant cockroaches, like the idea of, yeah. I don't,
truly gross, truly gross. And the mutated bear and stuff like that. And it was just like, but anyway, like I said, you could tell they were outside a lot of the time and they built sets and, you know, the town of Philly that where the first big gunfight takes place, they built that whole thing. And it's, I don't know why I'm like harping on this so much, but like big CG sci-fi shows nowadays don't go places, they don't do things, they shoot all inside on green screen, and it's just so nice to see that they built like a big vault set, and like, and it was evident that they
No, and you're right, by the way. I mean, that was one of the first notes I wrote watching that first episode, was the production value is incredible, just the design. And you know, like you said, you can't recreate the desert, you can try, it's just not going to work, but by shooting it that way and then going and building an entire vault so that you really feel like you're in it. You know, it's a great contrast, which is you're in this sterile, claustrophobic enclosed space where things are finely tuned versus this wild open world that is super dangerous, but it's also freeing. It doesn't just look great. It contributed to what's actually going on in the show in a meaningful way.
Yeah, and I think it just like brings this scale that we were saying that you just like, you really can't replicate. Like Ella Purnell said in some interview that they took like a 5-hour helicopter ride to some shipwreck ruins that had literally never been like seen by human eyes for like a long time or something like that. And I was like, yeah, that's exactly what you feel and what you see in the show. And if the actors are also feeling and seeing it, I think it just takes it to like a whole better other place than just being in a studio or on a set.
There's something to like that. The I think, what is it, episode 3 maybe or 4, I forget which one of the episodes, where the ghoul is kind of dragging Lucy around and like it looks miserable, and it's like, that's another thing you can't really fake, is like the misery of being out on those real locations.
The actress that I interviewed for Maldaver, Sarita Chaudhry, she was saying that, like, you know, she was filming Sex and the City before the Sex and the City sequel before. And she was like, yeah. And then I got onto the set, and like day one, I was in this dirty old suit, and suddenly there was dirt on my face. And I was like, yep.
Yeah.
This is real.
Yeah. That's great. Okay. So we'll get into the I guess let's just follow like each character through and through. So Lucy is, I think, our in character for the most part. And I loved the first episode because she is like an overachiever. Like, she's just so like, everything in the vault is great. I just need to find a man because blah, blah, blah. And there's like all the implications that like nobody, you're in a vault. Like, you make do with what you have, but they understand that they can't procreate with their cousins and stuff like that. I find that very funny. And nobody thinks it's weird because it's been 200 years and it's like, you got to do what you got to do. And then the second she gets outside, she learns how horrible everything is. And like throughout the, you know, I think the big turning point for me with her was when she is that episode or that couple episodes with the Matt Berry robot in like the weird drug store. And she comes out and like, you know, she, to me at that point, she's like, okay, now she understands the world. And for the rest of the show, she's going to be a lot more wary of what's going on. We don't swear on this podcast, but if we did, there'd be some choice words that she says to the ghoul when she's leaving. That's truly great. Golden rule, MF-er. Yeah. What I really liked her. I mean, I like Ella Purnell anyway, but she was really good on Yellow Jackets, which that I won't spoil it. But there's a very funny question that you asked her, Ro, pertaining to both Yellow Jackets and Fallout. But
yes.
What did you guys think of Lucy as like your protagonist for the most part? Because I think there's three main protagonists, but like I still think she's sort of the audience surrogate there.
No, she is. And she, you know, it's such a great type of character to have for a show like this, because she can be our eyes and ears for newcomers to the franchise like me and Ro, where we have a perfect excuse. It makes sense in the story for her to be mm-hmm. discovering new things so that we can discover them together. I think if she's not as good as she is in this role, nothing really works. I know that's essentially true of all three, but I think she has the most important role because she really is kind of the center of this. You know, it's her father who's involved, and she's the one who's really kind of figuring out this mystery of everything going on. And she's the one with the who sets out right to find him. And that's kind of the entire season. And if she's just not that good, maybe it's an A- instead of what I think is an A+ season, maybe even lower. And her transformation from where we meet her to where she is going off with the ghoul at the end of the season is totally believable. It's logical. It's paced well. You know, it makes sense. And she has these moments, you know, when she cuts off his finger, that's a big change for her, but it's totally believable. It doesn't seem like it comes out of nowhere, you know, because right before it, I think it's right before that, she's drinking the radioactive water because she's so desperate. She holds the whole show together, and I love that character, and I love how they used her.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think that her sort of transformation is, as Mikey said, just super well handled. And I think there's a huge question that kind of her character represents about like Fallout and sort of the apocalypse and these bigger themes that they're playing with in the story, which is like, it was so easy for Lucy to be a good person when Lucy had everything and everything was easy. But can you maintain the idea of being a good person when things get hard? And I think this show really like uses Lucy to be like, you can maintain this optimism. You can remain a fundamentally good person and sometimes have to do things that you wouldn't choose to do if you didn't have to. So I thought that was like a really interesting, you know, journey for her character to take us all on. And I think that Ella Purnell really does play this like innocence, but this sort of these undertones or these implications of like a darkness in her that like she balances really well. So you can imagine how she could just go totally crazy or like give in to sort of the temptations of the wasteland or the evils of it. But she has that inside of her, but then she actively chooses like to modulate what of that she takes with her. So like enough to grow and evolve, but like not so much that she loses everything that she is. And I think that's like a really difficult line to toe, and Lucy's narrative towed it really well.
It's a really tough thing to play also, like, because she's clearly, she's naive, but she's not like helpless at all. Like she's very capable, but also just doesn't know what the world is. And it's also really tough to be the character for whom you know, not like she knows nothing. She's been told stuff, but then she very quickly finds out that it's all not true. And then at the end, like so much of the ending kind of reveal with her father, played by Kyle MacLachlan wonderfully, is that like everything she thought she knew about, even the inside the vault stuff, which she thought she knew inside and out, is false. And so there's so much of it. They keep showing her face just kind of falling. And then eventually it's like, oh, she's willing to just let him, you know, die, which he doesn't, obviously, spoilers. I think that, I mean, that is a huge moment for her where she just is like, I came all this way to save my dad. I love a quest narrative too, by the way, like, you know, let's trudge and try to find somebody. But, and then it's, she, to the point where she'd rather go off with the ghoul and figure out what's actually going on. Like, I think that is such a great place for the season to end and kind of figure out, you know, now what the new status quo is with her life, but also like with the world, with the, you know, cold fusion existing and everything. I thought it was tremendous.
Yeah. I think it is such a credit to like Ella Purnell's acting that in that sort of final scene, Lucy says so little, but you go on such a journey with her, like through just like everything that's happening with her face, you know, like, you just like, you go through this whole like realization, this understanding, this anger, and like she barely says anything at all, but it just is like a very strong scene that she hinges, you know.
And you know, I think that scene exemplifies what the show does so well, because they don't play it for sentimentality, right? There's a little bit, is she going to shoot Moldaver? Is she going to shoot her father? Whatever, right? And instead, she just, Mercy kills her mom, right? She doesn't say it. She's not crying. It's nothing. And it's just shows without telling and without playing, you know, trying to pull on our heartstrings. It just lets it speak for itself. No, this is who Lucy is now. She's not going to kill her father because she's not going to allow herself to be that type of person. But she has learned enough that she can do something that she definitely could not have done even a week earlier, right? Her mom is there. Yeah. This is no way for her mom to live. She's just going to take care of business. And now we're going to go and we're going to take care of the next set of business, which is stopping the person who is doing all of this. And it's just so well written and so well performed. And then, you know, as we talked about, you had the production values. It's why I really do kind of think that this is a kind of a special show in that sense.
Yeah, Mikey and I were talking in one of our after hours chats about Fallout, about how good the blocking is on the show. Like just the setup, the characters on the screen, it just like tells its own story. And like, I think Mikey just said it, like the show don't tell quality of this show, where they're like not, they explain things that you need to know about the world, but in their own story, they're not compelled to like immediately throw everything onto the table and make sure you really know this is who this character is, this is where the story is going, this is what will happen next. You know, I think this show really takes its time, and I know many shows feel like they cannot take their time because the future of the next part of the story is just so unclear in the like landscape of TV today. Like that's just the fact of the matter. But I felt like this show is like, well, we will take our time. We will confidently unravel our story. We will not try to stuff every single thing we want to say in right in these 8 episodes. And hopefully we'll get to continue to tell it. And I thought that's a very impressive quality for a show.
And in that respect, like, Jonathan Nolan is no slouch. Like, he kind of figured out, and as much as Mikey hates the show Westworld, but like, there was an element in those shows of like, or of those seasons, I mean, of like, we are telling this particular story with these characters and there will be an unfolding mystery. And I think it worked so much better in Fallout just because you have such a strong world to begin with. You're not trying to concoct a crazy sci-fi world out of nothing. And you know, he says, you know, in many interviews, but like, he was a fan of the games first, and that's like, he wanted to kind of adapt the world of the Fallout games, and that's a huge part of it. Yeah. Oh, what was I just about to say? Oh, who cares? Please do.
Well, I just want to add one thing. When you're movies and TV shows, there are two types of mysteries, right? When you don't really know everything that's going on, the ones where it's intentional and the ones where it's not intentional. And you only have to know that you're not supposed to know something. That's fine, right? The mystery when it's intentional is engaging. Shows and movies run into problems when you're confused because they're doing a bad job telling the story. And at every step of the way here, I was like, oh, I don't know the answer to that, but I'm not supposed to know it. Same as the characters, or just because they're holding something back. And that's why it's so engaging. And we didn't actually get into it, but we all wish that the show had come out weekly so we could have dissected. Right. There's only so much we can do when they drop them all at once. Yeah. Right. We've written a lot of pieces about Fallout. Go to Nerdist.com, the best website in the world. Read all about it. But if we had been getting these episodes weekly, we would have been writing multiple pieces about every single episode, about certain scenes. We can't do that. But I will say, because they gave them to us all at once and we tried to do it, I watched the first 5 episodes in one day, and I was really sad when I didn't have time to watch the next one. And then when I came back a couple days later to watch the final 3, I was like, I kind of wish I had just finished these all in one. So I get it. But it's still not an argument for dropping them all at once. This is too good. This is too good. And there was too much to dive into, too much lore, too much history, too many theories we could have come up with. And I know we'll probably get to that later. And it just would have been a more engaging communal experience. And I think that's always the best way to enjoy television.
And, you know, Dan, our colleague, Dan Casey, said from the beginning, this is a show that could have dominated the pop culture conversation for months. Because of if it had done it weekly, and you know, the fact that it didn't, and it's already kind of on the wane, like, we're putting this out relatively late and it only came out 2 weeks ago. You know what I mean? So, or 10 days ago even. So I feel like it's a very fine line to, when it comes to like how much or how quickly you want to show things. And I think we all kind of like the general or the usual prime way of doing things, which is like, give us 2 or 3. And, you know, Eric Diaz calls it the pusher mentality. Like, I'll give you a taste and then you're going to want more every week. And it's never going to be as much as before. But I think that totally would have helped a lot. Like, give us the first 2, that really sets up the world and the characters. And then the rest from there would have been, you know, what adventure do these people befall? But to your point about the mystery aspect, I think there's a big difference between something like this and something like even Westworld, but like Lost is the big one, where like it's not knowing something, but knowing that there is an answer there. We just don't know it yet. And the characters don't know it yet. Whereas Lost is like, it's a mystery and they didn't know the answer. And you know, and that's how you get stuff. And that I think is the problem with the mystery box way of telling stories, is that it requires little on the part of the creator of actually like having anything in mind or like setting, you know, laying the seeds of like what it actually is going to be. And that was the same thing that befell Game of Thrones toward the end, is that they were like, stuff was set up and then they were like, oh, we're going to change it because everybody figured it out. That's not the way storytelling works. And like, even if we had theories, like if this had come out weekly and they had been proved correct, that's not a failing on the part of the show. That's a success, really, is that I don't ever want to watch a mystery in which there is no way to figure it out, because that's not fun. Like, people want to be able to figure it out and then, or go, oh, I thought it was this, but it was this, you know, like that kind of thing. It still needs to make sense. And I think everything about Fallout reveals in those last two episodes was like devastating. Cause it's like, oh my God, all of the people from Vault 31 were Vault Tech or, you know, consortium employees who were frozen and stuff like that. And it's just like, it smacks of a much bigger conspiracy. Like that cliffhanger at the end of the penultimate episode where Norm goes into Vault 31 and sees something, and then we don't learn until the next episode that it's actually Bud's brain in a robot, in a Roomba. They call him a brain in a Roomba, which is, I mean, there's your bad guy right there. And he's just like a little guy who can't do anything. But it's like, I thought that was such a great reveal because we had seen Bud so many times in the flashbacks, and you're just like, oh, this guy's a real jackass, but I kind of think he's going to be up to something, you know, up to no good or whatever. And then that proved true. And I think that works so much better than had it just been like, it was actually the leader of the Brotherhood of Steel or something like that. Would have not, there's no groundwork for that. That's just a surprise that has no basis in the show.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like you never want to feel like you're theorizing more than the creators of the show, right? You never want to feel like you're thinking a lot about this, like the reveals, the hints, the secrets, the mysteries, but they really haven't thought about it at all. And they're just doing like the suspense building for the sake of suspense building without like, you know, anything behind it. So I think that definitely didn't happen here. And like, that's a really great thing. And then even some of the theories that, you know, were sort of unfolding or like, Eureka, maybe it's this, you know, I think that we're following like set breadcrumbs to a logical conclusion. And that's how you want to feel when you're really engaged in a series. So that it's not like, oh, actually, it was just this thing from left field that you never could have guessed. So you really wasted your time like thinking about like how this could have happened or what this was. So I'm really glad to see that coming to fruition here. And even though, you know, if it had dropped weekly, we would have gotten more mysteries, more time to speculate, more sort of build. I think even though it did drop all at once, we still got a lot of that, which is, I think, kind of an amazing thing. I'm, you know, leading into season two, and this is on my list of things to say, but I feel like there really hasn't been a show in a little bit where everybody feels really engaged and like, oh, like what is happening with New Vegas or who did invent the ghoul medication or whatever. There's still like so many questions that we're left thinking about, but can trust that will pay off for us in time.
let's talk about Maximus next. I want to finish up, you know, do the ghoul last of the three. But so Maximus is a really interesting character because I don't ever really believe that he wanted to be part of the Brotherhood of Steel. He just felt like he had no other choice. And it was, I also Michael Rapaport as the actual Knight Titus, who is just such a jerk, like could not be less of a nice guy, and a coward and all that stuff. And what did he think was going to happen? You just insult a guy who is about to save you. Like, what are you doing? Like, you're so dumb. He's the dumb one. But then I like the idea of him trying to put on, you know, I'm going to be the knight now. Like, I'm going to, you know, fulfill this. I'm going to be the good guy. You know, when he goes and has that fight with the ghoul in Philly, it's like, he comes in like the hero. He's like, oh, I'm going to save the day. And then as the episodes progress, it's like, he's not, and that's fine. But then at the end, you know, history is written by the victors. Like, he didn't do anything. He was knocked out cold. And the other brothers come in and say, yay, hail Maximus. And it's like, he doesn't want that, but now he's conflicted in so many different ways, because like the happy ending would have been him going off with the other two, but that's not the way of the world. And now he's going to be stuck, I guess, with the Brotherhood of Steel. Cause that is a tough group to be part of. And I think that was the one that like, they maybe didn't spend enough time developing, and maybe they will in future seasons. But like, I know some people who are big game fans who are big Brotherhood of Steel fans who felt that that was not the visuals at all, but like the kind of exploration of the Brotherhood was very kind of surface level. Thoughts, Mikey?
Yeah, or, I mean, bro. I think that. Oh, take sorry.
Go for it.
I was just in the middle of the thought. I think that sort of speaking about mysteries and like questions, I think like how Maximus ended up in the Brotherhood of Steel is like a question that will still like develop in its answer, because we get this like sort of slowly elongating flashback of like Shady Sands being destroyed and this Brotherhood of Steel suit like, you know, being in front of him when he escapes from that milk carton container or whatever he was in, the fridge. So I think like what happens next is something that we will get to see, you know, as we continue to explore Maximus's story, because he had this kind of sort of this quote that is yet to be interpreted, where it was like, why did he join? It was because he wanted to like get back at the people who had done this to him. And it wasn't clear if he thought the Brotherhood had done this to him or somebody else had done this to him, the way I read it. So I think his relationship with the Brotherhood and how he ended up joining them, I think that flashback will continue in season two.
I think through the first few episodes, the part of the show that was maybe working the least for me were the scenes with Maximus. But that's because I don't think I really was appreciating what he was doing with the role. You know, it's easy to see Lucy as like, oh, she's this kind of weirdo who grew up in this weird setting. And we just think people on the surface, right? Oh, those people haven't been growing up in a weird setting, as though they're not in a dystopian wasteland with literal ghouls walking around. And as the show went along, I came to appreciate his performance more and more, because he's doing something very weird where he's just slightly off enough so that you kind of get that uncanny valley, which is usually unsettling, which I think is why maybe it wasn't totally working for me. But once I kind of got on that wavelength with him, it was one of my favorite performances on the show by the end, because he seems like he should be the most normal. And I think he's the weirdest of any of the major characters on the show. And for fans of the games, they didn't develop the Brotherhood of Steel as much as they would have maybe have liked to. But I can say I felt like I got everything I needed to from them. The group I felt kind of lost on was the Enclave. That's the group from the show that I felt I needed to go and do my own research to totally appreciate. And it's funny because they're such a major part of the games, the major, you know, antagonist of the games. But I feel as a newcomer, like I had enough of the Brotherhood to kind of get it. And especially when you get to the end and Dane admits that they cut up their own foot because they were desperate not to go out. And you combine that with what happens just with Squires in general, and the perfect, perfect, perfect casting of Michael Rapaport as an underwhelming goober loser that you can't wait to see suffer. Plus the character he played was pretty similar. You know, like I came away, I felt like I kind of knew what was going on with the Brotherhood, that I had all the information I needed to really appreciate what was going on with Maximus. And, you know, he ends up, like you said, there's such an easy path where they set up season two for the three to go out together, right? It seems so easy, but it wouldn't have been as satisfying, because, you know, that final, Moldavis final moments where she says, like, what will the Brotherhood do with unlimited power? You know, can anybody stop them? Maybe not, but you're the only one who can even try. I really loved it, because he really wants to be a knight, right? Like, he really does want to be a good person, because for all of the issues, I think he can clearly see with the Brotherhood. He does remember, like, when he was all alone, it was a Brotherhood, a knight of the Brotherhood who came and rescued him, right? They did give him something. And he's really conflicted with it. So he kind of wants to be able to epitomize the best ideals of this group that pretty clearly doesn't actually have good ideals, right? Like they are not. I mean, I'm sorry for people who maybe love them in the video games and want them to win. They did not come away from the show thinking the Brotherhood really needs to come out on top. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a very fascinating character, and I think you can't really appreciate until you see the fullness of the story from start to end with him.
Oh. Yeah, I agree with you, Mikey. And I think for me, Maximus is like an interesting kind of foil to Lucy, you meet him and you question, like, is he this ruthless, terrible person who hurt his friend to get what he wanted, basically? And of course, we later find out that didn't happen, but you're kind of left questioning that aspect of him. And then you can kind of see as he develops that he does have this, like, good heart and he does want to really help people. And then when they're in Vault 4, it's kind of like the reverse Lucy situation where you see that suddenly if you give someone everything they could need, it's so easy for them to be soft and friendly and open and just happy, you know? So I think those are all sort of interesting, you know, counterpoints with Lucy and Maximus. And the actors said that, like, they each sort of have something the other is looking for, which I thought was very interesting. I think that it's a very interesting relationship, but that Maximus still, I think the reason why he just couldn't go off with the other two is that he's still figuring out at the end of the day where he stands and what stance he wants to take.
Yeah. I loved the kind of relationship throughout the season of between him and Thaddeus, played by Johnny Pemberton, who's great.
He's so good.
He's
so good as Thaddeus.
From the beginning, he's like, oh, this guy's awful to me. He's terrible and all this stuff. And then you find out when Thaddeus thinks he's talking to Titus that I didn't actually have anything against him. I just got beat up when I was new. And so, you know, all this stuff. And Thaddeus ends up being like one of the most sympathetic characters for a lot of it because, like, oh, wow, he's just like, this is just the terrible system they're in. Like, the brothers could just kill their squire for absolutely no reason. And you kind of just have to do what they say, and you're the one who has to go in first. We saw that early on with Knight Titus where he's like, go in the cave. And it's like, I'm just going to die if I go in the cave. You're the one with armor on. And like, and it's like, the head brother or whatever, I forget the character's name, says at the end of the season where he's just like, we've completely lost our way. Like no one wants to do the right thing anymore. They just want kind of, safety and stability or whatever. And, you see where they lost their way, but also like the Brotherhood is a you know, crypto fascist kind of like warmongering group who think that might is right and all this stuff. And like only they have the power to save everybody. And it's like, they are not good, but they are members of them can be good and they can have, you know, ideals and everything like that, which is a really interesting thing. What's like the most iconic look from the game or anything about the show is the Brotherhood armor. And you want that to be, and I, you know, Bethesda has used that on every piece of marketing from any of the games that they put out since they bought it. And it's like the Brotherhood is the visual representation of what Fallout is. And yet they are kind of the least effectual for most of the series. If not, you know, we'll see going forward, but like with Maximus sort of leading the charge, is he going to do the right thing? Is he going to fall back on old habits and things like that? And I find that a really interesting kind of dichotomy there.
And also like, will he be allowed to do the right thing, or will he have to kind of listen to the sort of mass opinion around him to survive, which is, you know, another question.
We also know that he is,
there's no way we can, this group is supposed to be good when they send squires out with bags that are 800 pounds and taller than them. That's clearly coded. These are stupid people that we should not be rooting for.
Going to say that.
But I do hope that.
Please allow me to say this. No. That we know that Maximus is predisposed to, like, he wants to be adored, essentially. So, like, now that he is the one, he knows he didn't do anything to deserve this, but that kind of hasn't mattered too much in the past. And how quickly will he go back under that kind of spell of like, yeah, like this is all he's ever wanted, is to be beloved for heroism, even if he didn't deserve it. Please. Now you can talk.
Oh, I was just going to say that, you know, I feel like Thaddeus might reemerge to join our unlikely.
That'd be great.
Our unlikely party.
Now that he's a ghoul.
As the pal. Yes, now that he's a ghoul and Maximus saved his life, kind of, even though it wasn't like so altruistic as that, but from his perspective, like he did him a good turn. So I feel like we haven't seen the last of the buddy cop comedy between Thaddeus.
So one of my favorite things is that the snake oil salesman played by John Daly, who's just a funny character, and John Daly's a funny actor. But when he sees Lucy walking with Michael Emerson, who had just got his foot blown off, he's like, "Oh, I've got an elixir that'll grow your foot back." And you're like, that is clearly a lie he's trying to get. And then you find out, nope, he does have that. He actually does have an elixir that grows your foot back. It just happens to make you a ghoul. I found that.
It seems, by the way, it seems fine.
Depends on how ghoulish you care to be. Yeah.
Right?
I don't know.
I'm just saying, like, I don't know. Like, at least, I mean, I guess I'd rather be a ghoul with 2 feet than a human with one.
I said to Mikey, you know, seems like being a ghoul isn't a bad deal in the Fallout universe. But at that time, he was very indignant about ghoulism. And
for good reason. Tell him why.
Well, he said he wouldn't want to eat the butt jerky of humans. And I said, well, you probably can't smell or taste it as a ghoul. And he said, that's not really my chief complaint about consumption.
That is not the smell and the taste is not what is preventing me from eating human butt jerky. Okay? For the record, I refuse to do it now.
The good, the bad, and the ugly are here.
I'm just saying, like, that, I mean, in that very specific situation, Thaddeus' foot, I mean, he was going to die, right? He wasn't just going to lose his foot. He was going to die.
Gangrene.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, like, you know, old Coop seems like he's having some fun. As
you basically have to have, you know, constant drug cocktail to just stave off madness. And you have to.
What are we doing as humans now?
Newly added, though, I didn't see that drug cocktail in the other parts of the game lore, right? I feel like that's like the show's
that might
special
be
twist.
That might be true, because I know there are ghoul, like, sentient ghouls in the games, like, it's not like, but it is sort of like eventually that's going to happen, like, that's just sort of the way that everything kind of goes in the games. But all right, let's talk about Coop, aka the ghoul. Maybe the best character in modern literature. He's so good and perfect casting. Walton Goggins is so good as this character, as both the cowboy movie star guy from the before times, and then just fully embraces the kind of like lone drifter, you know, morally compromised cowboy that he is forced to play in that last movie that he makes. And it's just like, oh, he completely buys his own thing, but he can back it up. Like, he is the ultimate badass, but he's completely without, he has no compunction about killing whoever and whenever and everything like that. Really gorily. I knew there was going to be gore in this show, but like, holy cow, like, he's got exploding rounds that just completely destroy people's heads. And it's like, it's great. But anyway, what did y'all think of Cooper?
I'm really glad that you mentioned both of his performances, because his performance as the human actor is fantastic by itself. Obviously, he's great as the ghoul, but what's really impressive is that they feel like the same person, even though they are so different. They have the same foundation, and the core of the ghoul is the same core that was Cooper Howard. And just so everyone listening, there's a very good chance at some point I'm going to say Howard Cooper, because that's how those names should work. Howard is the first name, Cooper is the last. So just in case that comes up, because I have had to tell my editors numerous times to please check my work, not screwing up Howard and Cooper and Cooper and Howard. But yeah, he, you know, we see, and they got real close to being a little too on the nose with the whole filming the movie, where they say, oh, the audience wants to see a good man push too far. They got real close, I think, to being too on the nose, but ultimately pulled it off, because by the end, you know, this is who he's become, but he has not lost all of his humanity, right? Like, he is willing to do what it takes. He is pragmatic, but the core that made him a good human is still inside of him. And that is why he's a compelling character. You know, he's not, I mean, look, it's a classic, right? It's a classic character, right? This kind of lone gunslinger wandering the wasteland who still has an ethical code, even if he seems like he's a, you know, otherwise a bad person. What elevates it, though, in this case is Walton Goggins, who is awesome in everything he ever does. And I'm watching the show thinking, you know, I know he's been on other shows, obviously, and he gets praised all the time, but this is such a leading performance that you really, all I could think was like, why did it take so long for this type of role? And I'm sure, I know he's done other shows, but let's face it. This is a big budget Prime Video show. You know, it's got Amazon money behind it. And all I could think was like, boy, if I were making a movie soon or a television, he'd be like near the top of my list. Cause it doesn't matter what you give him. He's good in every single thing he does.
Yeah. Yeah. He's one of the best. Like, he was great on Justified. I think that was maybe the first time I ever remember seeing, I know he was on the Shield, I think, before that, but, in The Hateful Eight, he was like one of the only people who wasn't either like a crazy big star or like part of the Tarantino repertoire. And he ends up like basically sharing that movie with Samuel L. Jackson. And it's like, he's so good in that movie. I was really excited that it was him. And you're right. Like, he completely embodies the good man who is pushed too far. But by the time he's the ghoul, he's been pushed too far for hundreds of years. And so he's like way over the line. But I forget who even asks him. Somebody asks him at one point, like, why do you even bother going on for so long? You've been around forever. And he never answers the question, but it's because he wants to find out. He's a cowboy. He's out, you know, he's the bounty hunter out for revenge. Like, he's, you know, and he even, like, to the good, the bad, and the ugly point.
Ooh, there are out scenes, for revenge, huh?
Yeah.
Out for his, I don't know. Or I mean, just like,
out to find, you know,
he's to out. Find his family.
The Searchers is a movie.
Maybe it's both, Ro. Maybe it's both.
Whoa.
Oh, have I been let in on a conversation you both have had before?
No. But if I mean, I've been waiting for this lead-in to talk about Vegas, New Vegas. We can do it now. Or we can wait. But I'm telling you, he could be both looking for his family and revenge. Considering
I was more pointing out the dual nature of his character. And how you might read the ghoul.
There are a couple of I do want to talk about the future, the New Vegas of it all. But there are a couple things I want to mention first. There are certain scenes that are directly pulled from Westerns, which I love. The scene where he is in the house and Eric Estrada and his son come in. That is a scene that is basically lifted directly from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly with Lee Van Cleef. One of my favorite scenes. And it's like, you know, those guys are going to die before as soon as they walk in, they're dead. And it just is a matter of time. The other thing that I wanted to mix is the government who, you know, arrest him at some point. So the leader of them is wearing an all white kind of like Colonel Sanders type costume. And it's modeled on Boss Hogg from Dukes of Hazzard. What was the name of the character? Do you remember the name of the character?
Of the president of the government?
Yeah.
No.
It was Sorrel Booker was the name of the character. The actor who played Boss Hogg in the Dukes of Hazzard's name was Sorrel Book. So he is more Sorrel Book than Sorrel Book. He is Sorrel Booker. I found that very funny if you know 1970s television. Because nobody's named Sorrel. And so initially I was like, is that not the Dukes of Hazzard guy? The other the guy who played Gramps, is that his name? Uncle Jesse on Dukes of Hazzard's name was Denver Pyle. These are just things I know. Anyway.
Love that. Yeah. just about the ghoul for 1 minute. I think that when I was speaking to Walton Goggins, he was like, why does he continue? Like, is it revenge? Is it anger? But for me, it's like one specific thing. So I feel like there's like a more sort of heartfelt like journey he's on as well. And I think that he is on his journey to, you know, to becoming more of a hero. Like, that's as a studious student of these kind of characters, that is my takeaway. You know, like, he killed the dog, which was crazy to me. But then at the end, like the dog is coming with him. So I feel like it's like we're going to see the ghoul transition into back into more of like a
I absolutely see figure. That. I think he's just he's been amoral for such a long time and just sort of existing on anger. But that's one of the best, you know, we see so much in the flashbacks of him and his wife and his daughter, and we know from the opening minutes of the show that like he and his daughter were both caught in the blast. And yet at yes. the end of this season, he is asking, "Where's my family?" Implying both his wife, who probably is, you know, in carbonite somewhere, but also his child must still be alive, or the implication is that she's still alive somewhere. So I found that like a really interesting wrinkle that he's like, maybe he's, you know, he's trying to get the drugs to survive and all that stuff. And that's why he's taking a lot of the bounties. But he's also like, I'm looking for these answers. And that too is like the Searchers. Like he spends hundreds of years in the movie, The Searchers. It's 7 or 8 years or something like that. But looking for the answers. And now he finally has the answers. And he has somebody that he needs to find to get him, which is Kyle MacLachlan's character. Yeah, so let's move on to sort of what we think is going to happen in the future. The hopeful season one. They haven't announced it. Or have they? They have. Okay. They have announced it. Everyone, I knew that up from the beginning. I pay attention to everything we read on nerds.com. But yeah, so what do we think? What are our New Vegas thoughts? I mean, that is, if you've not played any of the games or even know about the games, the last shot, my wife was like, "Is that Seattle?" And I was like, "It is not Seattle." Oh, and she's like, "Oh, it's the Stratosphere." It's like, "Yes. Yeah, it's the Stratosphere."
She was not the only spouse that had that question. fortunately, they confirmed it with the, cuz I both loved and hated that every end credits had its own art, only yeah. because yeah. It was very cool and it looked great, but you're also like, okay, next episode. I guess I got to wait 60 seconds and show patience like every other human being in humanity's history.
Yeah.
I have some questions and some thoughts in regards to New Vegas and Coop's family. The wife pretty clearly was an evil mastermind, right? She's the one who says at that meeting, that Vault-Tec meeting, will drop the bombs. Like yes. that's her idea. So she seems like the number one suspect to be leading things from New Vegas. And the fact that he says, "Where's my family?" He seems to know that his wife and daughter are alive. But I don't think it's as clear cut as it seems, because if she was the mastermind behind dropping the bombs, starting the Great War, how did she allow that to happen while her daughter was with him?
Right.
If she exactly. if she's the one who does it, how does she not make sure that her daughter is with her the moment the bombs are going to go off? They're safe. They say, you know, on the radio, they say on the TV or the radio right before the bombs go off, like, "The president's missing." And we know from the game lore that the president knew what was coming and was already in hiding. That's the enclave, right? The high ranking mm-hmm. government officials. And so would Barb let this war start when her daughter was not safely in a vault, presumably where she is and where all of these other Vault-Tec executives are? Maybe things got out of hand, or maybe she simply tried to stop it at the last second and couldn't. You know, maybe she just got this train rolling and there was no way to bring it to heed when she realized what she was doing. But the fact that she was involved, she's still a prime suspect. But I think that also means that her daughter is a prime suspect to be leading New Vegas. And that would be quite a twist for poor Coop, who's, you know, been spending all this time staying alive and staying non-feral so he could find his daughter, only if he finds out she's the mastermind behind the wheel this whole time. Obviously, there are, I'm sure, you know, we can go digging through the games and come up with lots of suspects from them for who it might be. I don't think that would be quite as satisfying, just because there are going to be lots of people who only know this world from the show. They're not going to start digging quite as much as we do. But it was without even knowing a lot about the Fallout games, even when I saw Vegas, I gasped because I know an entire game took place there. And it's like, oh, this is really coming together now. It's really bringing it in. It was a fantastic ending. Who they cast to play Hank, who turned out to be the complete opposite of what we thought, was also fantastic. Kyle MacLachlan is great in that role, and I really hope we get to see a lot more of him in season two, you know, because we really only got the first and the last episode.
Yeah.
But it was
fantastic ending. And I think that that Where Is My Family line completely changes everything in a way. Like, it would have been really interesting. We would have talked about it, but boy, does that add all new layers to this onion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just off that, what you were saying about where, you know, how Coop had his daughter when the bombs dropped, I was also like really interested because, like, if you know nuclear apocalypse could happen at any minute via like this crazy corporation, how do you just go back to like performing at children's birthday parties? Like, to me, there seemed to be sort of a disconnect there between the fact that he knew about this potential like coerced apocalypse and then like this sort of, he was clearly been disgraced for some reason, but it was like he was sort of continuing with everyday life and staying in Los Angeles, like a major population hub. So for me, I'm just like very curious, like, yeah, what happened between when he found out, when he heard his wife say that very dramatic bit about dropping the bombs, and like when the bombs actually dropped, because it seemed like there's a lot still to go there.
Yeah, there's a few factors that make it seem like the end of the flashback section of the last episode takes place months, if not like a year or so before the events of the opening scene. And that, like you're saying, he wouldn't immediately go from King of Hollywood essentially to working kids' birthday parties overnight. So clearly stuff happened, like that. There's the guy, the dad at the party who like do the thumbs up. That's what you're known for. Like, yeah, all that kind of stuff. So clearly there was some sort of fallout of surrounding Vault Tech or something like that. The other thing is that Bud is a brain in a jar. So he clearly, something happened to him. He's not just, he wasn't just frozen. And maybe it was a function of he needs to be awake forever. And that was a choice on his part. But the other option, it seems like he would be like, maybe he was caught in the blast or something like that, and so they just saved his brain before he became feral, or, you know, there's any number of things. But like, since he literally is the mastermind of the corporatocracy or the kind of bureaucracy element of the consortium of things, I think that's really interesting. The other thing about New Vegas is that in the game New Vegas, the rulers of the actual city are Caesar, who models himself on the Roman Empire, and they've kind of become that, and they take over Caesar's palace, which is amazing. And so that's something that's a whole other faction that we've seen. And that kind of, you know, your point about not really knowing who the Enclave are. We also don't really, we see little bits of them, but like another huge faction from the game is the NCR, the New California Republic. And they are present in New Vegas as well. So there's like all sorts of, and then there's Mr. House, who is probably that guy from Robco. I think that's more or less confirmed, because, you know, he's got the mustache and everything. Mr. House is the AI that runs everything, which is cool. And I don't want to give away. Okay, I won't give away. There's a really fun kind of double twist with Mr. House, which I won't give away. But that also means that we might get to see Yes Man, who is the best cowboy robot in the entire world. In the game, it's voiced by Dave Foley, and he is a helper robot who is only programmed to say yes and to be helpful. But so he goes, he's like, I won't overthink this at all, and this is a perfect idea. Like, he says stuff like that. So even clearly things that are bad ideas, he just goes, this is what we're doing, I guess, so I'm going to do it. And it's so good. So I love Yes Man. So I hope we get, I hope we get him, and may as well just have Dave Foley do the voice because he's still around and he can still do the voice. So there's lots about New Vegas. New Vegas is, I think, widely regarded by most big Fallout fans as the best game. So I think that's a really interesting, like, let's go to that place. And I think maybe having Coop's daughter either part of the Roman, you know, the Roman Empire, if they even choose to do the Roman Empire.
Yeah, because I mean, there's 15 years, I think,
right,
between where the game ends and where this show is. So, you know, when Ro mentioned there are multiple endings that you can get and follow New Vegas, which means that they can choose any of them, or it doesn't matter what they choose, because they can just say, oh, in the 15 years since that, things have changed dramatically. Like, they don't even have to really be beholden to it, which is why
No. I think it's really interesting to, and I've we've done this, learn all about those endings and what they could be different, but also at the same time be like, don't put invest too much time into theorizing, because either three or all four of them won't matter, because they just might be like, oh, yes. Yeah, five years ago, somebody came in and took over, and now there's a new person here.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's all.
Go ahead, please.
I can't help but wonder if they like won't really choose an ending, you know, because that to me seems like it would really be against the whole project of the series.
There can't be a canonical ending to any one game, because then that solidifies things that like, you know, it's what is it called? Quantum energy. Like once you see it, then it's only one point and it needs to be all. And so I think you're right. Like they might just go, it's been 15 years since the fall of the Roman Empire, or the fall of New Vegas, or I guess they would just say the fall of the New Vegas, because you can win as the Roman Empire in the game too. So
maybe we should mention though, it is important. New Vegas is important no matter what though, because of the Hoover Dam, which provides clean water and, you know, power. There's energy there. Yeah. So that's, I mean, it's even if they do exactly that, which I think is probably where the smart money is, right? That they're just not going to lay claim to any of the endings to the game. They're just going to kind of do a soft reset and use that 15-year gap. But it doesn't change how important that region is, because the Hoover Dam is still there and operating.
Yeah. And I think that actually that makes a lot of sense, because, you know, I'm not a game aficionado, but in my understanding, none of those endings really involved Vol-Tek in a meaningful way. And now it's absolutely. Like Vol-Tek has come to claim New Vegas because they want to control the whole world. And then New Vegas was such a like source of power. And now, of course, Moldaver has released power. So it's like, how important is controlling that source of power now? But I think it makes total sense that instead of going with any of those other endings, they'll be like, actually, Vol-Tek now runs New Vegas.
Yeah.
And continue from there.
Right. Yeah. I'm hoping that we get, a good sense of that town, because, you know, Philly is a very small area, which we got to see pretty well. And like, Shady Sands was destroyed, but we see it in little bits and bobs here and there. But like New Vegas is a huge, like bustling, for lack of a better term, like area. The strip is big. So I hope we get to see a lot of that. I also hope we get to see like how treacherous the area surrounding New Vegas is, because like in that game, like there's bloat flies, which are the little ones. And then there's, I forget what they're called. Oh shoot. Cazadores, or Cazadores perhaps, are these huge giant like flies that can eat you and kill you. And then also death claws, which we have not seen. We saw a skull of a death claw, probably, but death claws are like these huge kind of carnivorous lizard creatures.
Kyle, why'd you have to tell me about bow flies? I'm trying to live my life here. I'm just, like an idiot. I just looked it up to see what they're so much bigger than I thought. I somehow Fallout is making me from a guy who doesn't care about bugs into the, like the most anti-bug person in the world.
Oh, yeah.
Except for bees. We need bees. Unless they're giant bees.
Oh, we need.
Just on your point, Kyle, about how it's like a bustling city, I almost wonder if it's kind of not anymore. I don't know, just seeing it from a distance.
Oh, yeah, maybe. Yeah.
It kind of seemed kind of desolate. And then in that sort of ending, those ending frames, they show this New California Republic helicopter kind of crashed in the middle of the street, and like a deathclaw skeleton just like decaying. And of course, I don't know how seriously we should take those frames or not, but yeah, it's interesting.
And we also haven't seen, I mean, there's so much in the Fallout universe that we haven't seen. So there's room for like discovery from the audience perspective, but like super mutants are also a big thing, which we haven't seen really any of.
Just the hand at the Enclave.
Yeah.
Which was, blink and you miss it, but it felt like a potentially big little setup. I mean, obviously it could just be nothing more than a fun little Easter egg, but that it definitely could be the type of thing that has a big payoff later.
I just feel like it's something that like they focused so heavily on those three from our lead characters, with little bits here and there of everybody else. And I think that it's just going to grow from there. Like Vol-Tek is, if they are going to be the focal point, like kind of evil for a while, or at least like the oppressor people. We still need to see like how the rest of society, because we've only really seen how the LA basin is surviving or has, you know, whatever, what they've done. So seeing even just a little bit, you know, a few hours away in Vegas is like a big change, because you know, that's how feudal societies work, is that everything is completely different. So I would love to see like, you know, tribes of super mutants out in the desert or something like that, or you know, getting a little bit more of the enclave, like maybe New Vegas is there's the enclave has a bigger presence in New Vegas, let's say, you know, as an example. It would be interesting to see, because the enclave really is just where Michael Emerson was, and that's kind of it.
Well, and we wrote about this too, you know, this series raised real questions about whether or not Vault-Tec and the Enclave are just two parts of one whole.
Sure.
You know, so absolutely. So we might have learned more about the Enclave during season one than we realized, you know, and just might not have been revealed to us yet. And I thought that was great too. The way that they don't give answers is just a masterclass. And, you know, they still told a story. Lucy's dad gets taken in episode one, and we spend the rest of the season finding Lucy's dad, and that gets resolved without stopping the story. And we get lots of answers while raising lots of new questions. And that's, Ro, I think you said it earlier, something like, we really haven't had a show like this in a while. I'm sure somebody will say, oh, this was that. I felt the same way. I felt like, where has this been the last couple of years, that there's been kind of a gap, you know, because like even True Detective Night Country was a hit and people were watching it and it grew as it went on, but that's self-contained too. You know, other seasons could reference it the way it referenced season one, but it's still not the same. Maybe the last time we had a show like this was also Prime Video, but it wasn't nearly as successful, was The Rings of Power, which
that's what I was thinking,
which still is working from source material that's already written. Like we know exactly where the Rings of Power is going, whereas this is moving the story forward into new territory while building. And that's great. You know, I was thinking about that too, is, you know, I'm researching pieces for the site, and there's so much history and lore, and these shows tend to do so well because there's stuff to dig into, right? You spend an hour watching an episode, and then, you know, if this was a weekly release, you can spend a week reading about it, researching, talking about it. Even just dropping all at once, we're able to do that on a bigger scale. But it's so nice to have all of that stuff, but also be going somewhere new so that nobody knows where it's going. You know, nobody can tell you like, oh, this they're doing that for this. We're all just kind of in it together.
Everyone should be excited. If you haven't watched this yet, hopefully we didn't spoil it fully for you. But I don't know why you wouldn't have watched it already. I think, you know, that was like kind of the big show that came out in the last little bit. So do either of you have any final thoughts about Fallout season?
Sure. Yeah, I think like we've said, and Mikey just echoed, I think that I really just feel like, you know, just like an exciting piece of television in a way that, you know, hasn't been formed in the recent times. So it's always fun to dive into something that really engages you, gets you asking those questions, and then there's a lot to dig and there's more. So that's a lot to be excited for. And I knew I would love the ghoul from the very first screenshot of the ghoul, and I indeed loved the ghoul, and I can't wait to see, you know, him soften as the seasons go on.
That's your favorite. That is your absolute, from what I know about you, is that villains who become less villainous is your favorite character in the entirety of fiction.
That's right. And he's like an extra, like he is really on the like dark end of that. I would say that for me, he's in conversation with my other favorite Prime Video fella, The Rings of Power's Adar. I actually think they have very similar like trajectories. But actually Adar, the father of orcs, is like a softer, sweeter character than the ghoul. So there you go.
Yeah, there's people that he cares about from the beginning, which are the orcs. But yeah, right? The ghoul. Yeah, the ghoul is so like, rad. Yeah,
he's killing puppies. And I think it really takes a strong character to be able to kill a puppy and still be beloved. So
yeah,
good for you.
He saved it.
I think so.
Yeah. Stim packs immediately heal you, and I love that about the show. It's like, we're not going to spend time explaining how it works. It just works. Mikey, what about you?
Rapid fire. I don't think we talked just about how good that opening sequence is. It was really terrifying to see the bombs dropped on Los Angeles. It was... we've grown up in a world, you know, we're of the right age where we've grown up in a world where we've seen so many nuclear wars and movies and ideas of what a dystopian wasteland would look like. But I thought that the opening scene where people just kind of live in their lives, but also afraid of it, and then it actually happening, I thought that was as well done as I've ever seen. Norm is the greatest. Whoever saves Norm will become my second favorite character ever, even if it's the coward Chet. although they were setting that up really well with him and Birdie. And Chet's not a bad guy. He's not the stepdad. He's the dad who stepped up. Good for him. And finally, of all the things I wrote about Fallout, I think the one I'm most excited about, and I would really encourage people to go to the site and read about it, is this idea of the scene with Lucy's finger. It's a great bit of world building, right? But if you think about it, it doesn't make a total sense that this robot is about to kill her for her organs, but attaches the finger. And I think it could be setting up a future moment that, if it happens, will be one of my favorite ever. The show raised the possibility, if there is a ghoul medicine to keep you from going feral, and there's a ghoul medicine to turn you into a ghoul, the possibility that there is a medicine that can cure you of ghoulification. And if that were to happen, if Coop could be human again, no longer be a ghoul, he would not be able to regrow his ears and his nose. Ghoulification affects the connective tissue. That's why he could lose a finger, then stitch it back on and have it self-heal like Wolverine. But he can't grow his nose back. And even if he were to put a new nose on, it wouldn't stick. His body can't do it. But that little machine attaching Lucy's finger sure sets up a future human Coop getting his nose back, which would be awesome. And if this happens, I won't claim credit for it, but you feel free to say that I maybe influenced that happening.
How the ghoul got his nose back. That's great.
It was right there. It was right. Bad job by me.
Yeah.
And I think that's exactly the kind of humor I told this to make me. That's exactly the kind of humor this show really goes for. So I could really see like this dramatic, beautiful moment where like the ghoul stitches his nose back on. So
yeah.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, it's so good. I'm so excited for more, and I love, you know, any show that makes Chris Parnell a cycloptic bureaucrat in a vault, like, all right, they know what they're doing. They know the kind of stuff they're up against. All right, well, thank you everybody for listening to us talk about the Fallout series. Please let us know what you think of it. You can either tweet at Nerdist, or you can write to laserfocused@nerdist.com, or you can get in touch with us individually. And here is how. Ro, how can people get a hold of you and your work on the internet?
Yes, most of my work on the internet in written form lives on Nerdist.com. And as Mikey has said, we have some excellent and interesting coverage about Fallout. So please do go and check all those things out. Otherwise, I'm on Twitter at Moondancer1626 and on Instagram at Rotem_Rusak. And that's me.
Mikey.
You can find me on both Twitter and Blue Sky at Burger Mike, all one word. And I don't know if I've mentioned this, but you can find my writing at the best website anybody ever visited, Nerdist.com.
That's me making fun of the way you say that.
I didn't think I said it weird at all.
You're
right, you didn't. You can follow me on, I'm on Blue Sky too. I decided I'm going to try that one again at Kyle D. Anderson. You can also follow me on, Facebook's subsidiary Instagram. I haven't been on Facebook in 7 years. Instagram functional_nerd. You can also follow me on Letterboxd, Kyle_Anderson. So thank you very much again, Ro and Mikey, for joining me. Thank you all for listening. I've been Kyle Anderson. Join me again next week when my guest will be a different person. Bye-bye. Laser Focus is a production of Nerdist Industries and Legendary Digital Networks. It was produced, edited, and hosted by me, Kyle Anderson. For more, visit Nerdist.com.